Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing. What will a high-fat diet do? And most Americans are on a high-fat diet, I'll tell you. More good information on red grapes and red wine. What it can help reverse and prevent. Also today, I want to go a little bit more in-depth about how we can reverse the chances of a stroke. With tens of millions of Americans in an age group under stress and having the accumulation of plaque in their brain, there's something new that we can apply on a daily basis. I know a lot of people use chemotherapy when they have cancer because they're told this is what's been proven. It's not for me to tell people yes or no on any given therapy. I can certainly show them the faulty studies that have not been conclusive. But at the end of the day, more often than not, they'll make a decision based upon fear. And that's unfortunate. But there's something else if you use chemotherapy that's not good, and they've just discovered it. So I'll give you what happens when chemotherapy is used and what it can do that we didn't know before, but now we do. And also today, we'll talk about why do our bodies store fat when we eat in the evening. Now, I've suggested that we should have at least 3 to 4 hours between our last meal and going to bed. Now there's even more reason to pay attention to that and to do it. So I'll get into that. As you see, we have a lot of different issues in health, and always from mainstream peer-reviewed literature. I met a person in the airport just a couple days ago, and in fact, it was 2 days ago. And the person was just getting into a car and came over and says, "You're Gary Null." I said, "Yeah." And the person said, "Hey, I can't listen every day. I can almost never listen live, but I download your shows and I put them on this doodad that he had and listens throughout the day." And said, "I'm 33 years old. My generation has really had it rough. And yet you rarely hear anyone talk about what's happened to my generation. Could you address it? Because I know that you'll do it justice." Well, fine. Well, today I will address the group of people from 18 to 33, the millennials, because they're getting stressed by all that's happening. It's not going to get any better for them. Individuals may succeed, but the vast majority are going to have it rougher. Mike Shedlock from Global Economic Trend Analysis, the latest, my input. Now, I don't think I'll have time today to do a commentary that I spent a long time writing for today. If I don't, then I will do it on this evening's Progressive Commentary Hour at the beginning. It talks about I accuse, and I am accusing the entire establishment of the corporate Democrats and the corporate Republicans, the corporate liberals, and the corporate conservatives. I'm accusing all of you. But how am I accusing? On what specific issues? In an original commentary. I will give it when time permits. I doubt it we'll get to it today because my guest today is going to talk about our political disconnect with the Pentagon, and it's leading us to a crisis in national security and the cost of our militarism. So we really don't have a defense budget, because if we were actually defending Americans, we'd be spending about $100 billion a year. That's it. But we're spending $1.3 trillion a year. Massive militarizing. So that has nothing to do with defense. It has to do with private contractors. And how much money have private contractors made? Let me see. Well, there's actually an analysis of it. And it's very detailed, and it's very scholarly. Oh, and it's $3 trillion. Now you know why we must have a perpetual war on terror, or war on something, or make everyone afraid, or make everyone paranoid, or the FBI be the primary provocateur of setting up these stupid little sting operations to make it look like someone was going to blow up the world when they weren't, but the FBI convinced them they could and gave them the bombs and everything else, and then arrested them in this big brouhaha, all self-perpetuating. Professor Melvin Goodman, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., professor in governmental studies at Johns Hopkins University, and for 24 years, through the administration of Johnson to George Bush Sr., he served in the CIA and the Department of State as a Soviet analyst. He was also a professor of international relations at the National War College for 18 years. So he's going to be on today, and we're going to talk about the Pentagon, the military-industrial complex, and why you never hear Sean Hannity. Well, you couldn't hear Sean Hannity. He'd rather have a heart attack than take a penny away from the gazillions given to these greedy, corrupt bastards in the military-industrial complex. Isn't it amazing everyone else in the world can actually find the truth, and the people over Fox just are clueless? They're not dumb. And that means it's with intent. We're going to get into that. Let's begin. First up, you don't have to go far in America to see a high-fat diet. It's everywhere. It's the number one diet promoted on television. And all those foolish and egotistical chefs who are trying to show you, you know, how hip they are and why we should make them instant idols and how they should be instantaneously the best chef. And, of course, nobody pays attention to the food they're making because, A, you couldn't make it, and, B, if you did, you probably dropped dead of a heart attack. So we're inundated with bad food. High fat is extra bad. This is from mainstream science. This is reported in Medical News Today, published through the University of Illinois College of Medicine, and reported in the peer-reviewed journal Psychoneuroendocrinology. Here's what it says. Quote, we found that a high-fat diet rapidly affected dopamine metabolism in the brain of juvenile mice, triggering anxious behaviors and learning deficits. Interestingly, when Ritalin was administered, the memory problems went away. End quote. Now, what we know is this. When you alter someone's dopamine signaling, you're going to end up obese or overweight, especially in children, and then you can end up with ADD and ADHD. And when the number of dopamine metabolites is higher, anxiety behaviors in children are more prevalent. So that's what they are determining by this. So the high-fat diet is dangerous. It's linked to ADD and ADHD and learning problems. And yet, it was only about 4 years ago that I asked the members of this audience, if you have a child diagnosed and under treatment for ADD and ADHD, I'm going to do a study, a health support group. And we did. And I remember on the first day, the kids were just bouncing all over the place and yelling and screaming and couldn't sit still. But we, after that, I asked the parents to come but to leave the kids at home, and they did. And what we found was, in the original journals that they all had to write, they, unfortunately, were feeding their kids a lot of sugar, caffeine, and saturated fats. And so the first process was to get them off the fats, then the sugars, then the artificial sweetened products, and the dairy, and then to rebuild their whole immune system, their gut flora, and natural chelating agents. Because you're not going to get a kid to sit in a chair who's got ADD and put a needle in their vein and give them a drip of EDTA for 2 hours. That isn't going to happen. But you can give them drinks and have them drink throughout the day, and the drink is filled with natural chelators that will take the heavy metals like lead and mercury out. And all of them were very high in mercury. So, and a lot of the parents said that they had the ADHD or ADD symptoms after mass vaccines. So this is a study that just shows you how bad a high-fat diet is. And most children and most adults in America are addicted to high-fat foods. Red grapes, which means red grape juice, is good for you. This is a new study from the Journal of Head and Neck Surgery done at Henry Ford Hospital, Detroit. It says, red wine and red grapes contain resveratrol, a substance which appears to protect against hearing loss and cognitive decline. And then it goes into the actual study and talked about why noise problems and hearing loss can cause all kinds of problems. It can cause sleeping problems, communication problems. You're at a higher risk of heart disease because of greater prevalence of hypertension and blood lipids and blood sugar levels. And so those are just some of the problems. And what they did, they found out that by giving them resveratrol, made an enormous improvement because it turns off inflammation. And inflammation is present when you have hearing loss, cognitive decline, and aging. So it was a good study, and it made a difference. So one more reason why a glass of organic grape juice or a glass of non-alcoholic red wine, and you'll get some resveratrol, but the most resveratrol you're going to get if you just take a 100 milligram capsule. That's the best way. One more way to help with lipid emulsions that protect your brain after a stroke. This is from Columbia University Medical Center, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS One, and it says, triglyceride lipid emulsions rich in the omega-3 fatty acids injected within a few hours of an ischemic stroke can decrease the amount of damaged brain tissue by 50% or more in mice. The results suggest that the emulsions may be able to reduce some of the long-term neurological and behavior problems seen in human survivors of neonatal stroke and possibly of adult stroke. So, two things you could do. One, you could follow this example. And again, this is will be posted on my site today. But it's about the omega-3 fatty acids. So loading the body up with omega-3 fatty acids right after a stroke is crucial. Secondly, hyperbaric oxygen. That could help protect that part of the brain not yet destroyed. And even in people who have had a stroke as long ago as 6 years could benefit from hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And also, this is from Rutgers University. It's talking about the effects of prolonged chemotherapy on development of new brain cells and rhythms, quote, may be the cause of fog-like conditions known as chemobrain. Now, we know it's not unusual for cancer patients being treated with chemotherapy to complain about not being able to think clearly. They cannot connect thoughts or concentrate on daily tasks. Well, chemotherapy-induced cognitive impairment, what we call chemobrain, is common. But they haven't been able to figure out the cause of it. And new research is now trying to figure out the actual cause. And this was published in the European Journal of Neuroscience. And my suggestion is this. There is some very exciting new research out showing that magnetic strips that pulse a low, infrequent current through the brain can kill the cancer cells. That's something that's in stage 3 clinical trials in the United States. It's already had their trials there, and they had a substantial improvement in glioblastomas, which are a very fast-growing cancer and frequently lethal. And it was able to help 50% of the people and even cause those people, some to go completely into remission. One guy eliminated his cancer completely, and 24 months later, he still hasn't gotten any cancer back. But the others have substantially increased their lifespan. So there's a lot of therapies other than chemotherapy that could help the body. And we just have to be aware of it. Now, why do your body store fat when you eat at night? This is a study from Vanderbilt University, published in the peer-reviewed journal Current Biology. And here's what it says. It says insulin activity is controlled by the body's circadian clock. which helps explain why not only what you eat, but when you eat matters. And this is the first study to definitively show the connection between our circadian rhythm and insulin activity. Now, what it means is this. The findings suggest that a disruption in that rhythm can lead to obesity and increase the risk of diabetes and heart disease. So, here's the takeaway message. Eat your last meal at about 5 to 7 o'clock if you can, and make it a small meal. That should be your smallest meal of the day. Your largest meal should be in the mid-afternoon, lunch. And try not to eat before you go to bed. If you do that, then you're eating in the natural circadian rhythm. So your body isn't jolted by all these nutrients and all this blood sugar that's having to spike. That's why a lot of people that watch television at night, they'll go get ice cream, they'll go get something to eat, because they're used to having something when they watch television. Now they're laying there, they turn off the TV, and they're ready to go to sleep. Here's the problem. The food has to be digested. So now the blood sugar level is going to go up, and with that, insulin goes up, and that changes your whole circadian rhythm. That's highly anabolic. But your body is saying, hold on, it's midnight. I'm catabolic. I want to detox. I want to sleep. I want deep, rapid eye movement sleep. I want to rejuvenate. That's what you want to do. That's what the body wants to do, but you've pulled up in the garage, put on the brake, and then put your foot on the gas pedal. That's what it's like to eat so close to bed, and that's why a lot of people who eat at night and eat large meals at night, which you shouldn't do, that's why they're obese. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us today. I'm Gary Noll. Our guests will be coming up in about 15 minutes. I have a few, our health and nutrition, public health science section. I have the environmental section. And then I'm going to do a short piece for millennials, for the young people who think they've been left out of the discussions. Indeed, they have. We'll put them back in the discussions. And for those of you who are not a millennial, it'll give you a little better appreciation of what stress they're dealing with. All right? But we haven't had a special in a couple weeks, so right now is our new special, and here it is. In fact, I have it with me, because I travel with it. It is the Gary Noll new, this is brand new, 3-gallon emergency gravity water filter. Now, normally it's about $255. Today only, and this is only today, it's $149. Plus, you're getting 2 free Fit Seal respiratory masks. These are the super masks. These are not the ones you buy in the drugstore. These are if you're flying on a plane, if you're in a hazardous area, if you're around someone who's got the flu or cold. This is the most protection that I know that you can put between a barrier between you and the person or the environment that's infected. That's a big savings right there. Plus the shipping, the handling fee, I should say, is being waived also. So you're getting a whole lot of great stuff here. And you're getting what many consider the finest water filter, gravity water filter there is, because you don't need electricity, you don't need a tap, you can be anywhere at any time. It should absolutely be mandatory that you have one in your trunk in case you're someplace and you need water and you're in a crisis emergency in your house. So this is the one thing, just like a fire extinguisher, that we must have. Camping, emergency situations, every day where portable water is required. Now, the Gary Noll Water Emergency Gravity Filter is designed for use where pressurized and suitable portable water is not available. And it uses gravity to filter the water from the upper chamber through 2 ceramic filters, to super clean the water, giving you safe drinking water from almost any water source, which is then stored in the lower chamber. And the housing is manufactured from an FDA-approved high-density polypropylene. And it's extremely durable, and it's very lightweight. And it's portable, and it's self-contained, and it's really good. It reduces the different pathogenic bacteria by 99.999%, and inorganic removal 95, turbidity 98, absolute rating 0.9 microns. So you're getting, that's 99.99%. I don't know of anything that does it better. It has a 5 ceramic filter capacity. You produce 7 to 10 gallons per day. So it's terrific. And it's easy to travel with, and everyone should have one. So, and I've invited for just a moment Dr. Roy Spicer. Roy is the one who does all the research, and Roy is here. He has a PhD in microbiology from Rutgers University and is a water quality expert. Nice to have you with us, Roy.
Nice to be with you, Gary.
Roy, explain the other filters that are out there without mentioning names, and then explain what you found when looking at the tests on the Gary Knoll portable gravitational filter. We'll call it the emergency gravity filter.
Right. The most important feature is the filtration efficiency. And your filter, the Gary Knoll filter, was comparison tested against a filter that's used worldwide. And the worldwide filter has been used for years for waterborne diseases. We sent it out to a laboratory that's NSF approved so that it meets all the highest standards of testing. And what we found is that when you compare the Gary Knoll ceramic to the other worldwide used filter, it exceeded the filtration efficiency of the other filter. That means it can take out smaller particles and reduce bacteria and parasites more effectively than any other filter. And this is a test that we have the data available. So down even at 0.3 microns, which is far exceeding any other filter, it still had greater than a 99%+ efficiency in removing tiny, really small bacteria. And that's not available in any other filter on the market. So that's why the Gary Knoll filter gives you much more protection than any other ceramic available or any other filter.
Okay, good. Well, I thank you, Roy, for coming on and sharing that with our audience. So there you have it. Now, I'm going to give you a phone number now to call in and get this. Remember, A, you can find a better filter, get it. This is the best I know of in the world. And everybody at this time needs an emergency filter. If you doubt that everybody needs an emergency filter, just remember how many millions of people in the Northeast didn't have water because of Hurricane Sandy. With this filter, they would have had water anywhere they wanted, out of a swimming pool, all right, out of a river. So that's what makes a difference. And you're saving well over $100, but that's just today. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. And just, if you don't have to use it, great. But if you go on a trip, if you go into the woods, camping, if you just have it there, it's like an airbag in a car. You hope you never have to use that airbag, but it could make all the difference in the world. So there's no reason at $149, and you're getting all this extra free stuff today that you shouldn't have it. All right? Big savings, saving more than $100. 877-627-5065, plus peace of mind, knowing that no matter what happens, you've got a source of water. All right? Now, nice to have everyone with us today. This is something specifically for the young people. Young meaning between the ages of 18 and 33. They're called millennials. They're also called, according to Mike Shedlock, stressed. They've been, according to Mike, screwed by Obama, the unions, and the federal government. They're a lost generation. I have a book coming out for this generation, just waiting to get the other books. I have a lot of books right now that I've written, and to get them out, I'll be announcing the new books later this week. But there's one that's 880 pages just for the millennials. those looking, according to Mike, for a reason for sluggish housing and weak retail sales and low family formation rates, all you have to look is look at what's happening to the 18 to 33-year-olds. First, a lot of them don't have jobs. A lot of them have high school debt with no way to pay off the debt and few job opportunities beyond part-time employment in food service or retail. And millennials are the ones who Obama targeted to pay for Obamacare. Indeed, the forced inclusion of youth who will overpay for health care is supposedly what made Obamacare affordable. Yet, even with the youth, the Affordable Health Care Act, it's so unaffordable that companies opt for Obamacare. Not even some labor unions want it. And speaking of labor unions, the odds millennials will get the same benefit packages going forward that public unions receive today are not good. Nonetheless, expect hack rates on millennials to rise so that ungracious and unappreciative boomers get their benefits and the others do not. So that's why they're a stressed generation. So ask yourself, is it any wonder that based upon a study of stress in America by the American Psychological Association that I mentioned some weeks ago on this program, that the millennials and the X generation report an average stress of 4.5 on a 10-point scale, where 1 is little or no stress and 10 is a great deal of stress, far more than the baby boomers. The Huffington Post comments on the millennials coming of age in America's most stressed generation. Here's what they say. Not surprisingly, work is one of the biggest causes of stress, with 76% of millennials reporting it as a significant stressor. And many of these young people have come out of college or graduate school with horrendous student debt into a job market where there are not very many jobs. This has put their life plans probably on hiatus. And then the job numbers are indeed grim. According to Generation Opportunity, the unemployment rate for millennials rose to 13.1% in January, up 2 points from December. And among young African Americans, it's a whopping 22.1%. And if you count those 18 to 29-year-olds who have given up and dropped out of the labor force, the overall youth unemployment rate stands at 16.2%. And even for the lucky ones who are working, the picture remains bleak. According to the Economic Policy Institute, that between 2000 and 2011, wages adjusted for inflation fell by 11% for young high school grads and by 5.4% for young college grads. It doesn't help that, as the study by the Center for College Affordability found, 48% of working college grads are in jobs that don't require a college degree, and 38% are in jobs that don't require a high school diploma. The report concluded that from 2010 to 2020, while 19 million college grads will be hitting the job market, the economy will add fewer than 7 million jobs. And that's pretty serious. That means that 12 million additional young people will be out of work. And any of those heavily indebted, heavily stressed out millennials listening to President Obama's State of the Union speech would not have gotten much stress relief. He did acknowledge the increasingly untenable cost of higher education, but offered no solutions. So here are the fundamental reasons college costs have soared. A, quite simply making more profit for the universities that are profitable and building up larger cushions for those and expanding for those who are not, because they feel they have to keep competitive. Also, guaranteed student loans. Student loans cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. Untenable wage and benefit structures of teachers and administrators. Too much push for everyone to go to college, whether they are suited for college or not. Federal grants and other costly programs designed to make college affordable, but do just the opposite. And also, out-and-out lies and fraud for profit schools that lure students into believing they can afford to become a chef or a Java programmer. Lack of enough accredited online universities, and no competition in general. So the millennials are screwed by all of those reasons. They also are getting hit by the Fed policies that punish savers to the benefit of already wealthy. Millennials became debt slaves in the process. to the benefit of the banks and the school administrators. Stressed by that, you bet. And here's what one Daily Beast had to say on it, on their blog. How has this generation been screwed? Well, let's count the ways, starting with the economy. No generation has suffered more from the Great Recession than the young. Median net worth of people under 35, according to the U.S. Census, fell 37% between 2005 and 2010. The wealth gap between younger and older Americans now stands as the widest on record. The median net worth of households headed by someone 65 or older, this, by the way, is net worth, is $170,000, and as a percent higher than 1984, while the median net worth of younger age households is $3,600, down 68% from a quarter century ago. That's according to the Pew Research Institute. Well, Chris, quick prospects for improvement are dismal for the younger generation. One key reason? Their indebted parents are not leaving their jobs, forcing younger people to put careers on hold. And since 2008, the percentage of workforce people under 25 has dropped 13%. And this generation also enters adulthood loaded with a mountain of boomer and senior incurred debt, debt that spirals ever more out of control. The public debt constitutes a toxic legacy handed over to the offspring who will have to pay it off in at least three ways: through higher taxes, less infrastructure, and social spending, and faithfully the prospect of painfully slow growth for the foreseeable future. So, for those of you who lack a durable paid employment, for those who have few opportunities for occupational and career trajectories, for those who have lower or no income and purchasing power, who are heavily in debt, who have no ability to save, you have few options, why not do this? Here's my own idea as a possible way of helping. Why don't the college students in America begin to join one another in demanding certain laws or rules that could help you? After all, you have been standing by as major corporate interests have manipulated the political system through ALEC, the group of 400 major corporations for 40 years, lobbying quietly behind the scenes, working with your state legislators to give them bills that became laws, all to the benefit of the corporations. You have all these major Glass-Steagall Act and other things that happen in the way of rules being torn apart that protected us or new laws put in place, but it's never to your benefit. One example, you can't declare bankruptcy and get out of student debt. So why don't you all just go on general strike? Challenge the universities. Universities hasn't helped you. They haven't been out there. If you decided to boycott all of the ALEC corporations, if you decided to boycott the major banks, put your money in the credit unions, buy from farmers market, Whole Food, or health food stores, and local. In other words, if the people who are exploiting you, including payday loans that are as high, according to yesterday's New York Times front page, is 500% interest, 500%. That's debt peonage. And now they've created debt prisons where you can go to prison if you don't pay your bills, even a small bill. And then you're charged for every day you're in that jail because it's a private jail. So why don't you fight back economically? You certainly have the intellect. You have the reasons. And you're all together within a university setting. Why not just ask, is it right that we continue to go forward after college and not be able to have, with few exceptions, the careers that we'd hoped for or the ability to maintain a standard of living? So boycott Goldman Sachs and Bank America and Citibank, and boycott any election that doesn't have third-party candidates viable and debating, like Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson and Gary Johnson. Boycott their products. Stop buying cheap Chinese-made and Indian-made products. Instead, buy American. Boycott that which is not environmentally sensitive and green. Stop buying what you don't need and stay out of the fast food joints. stop trusting official positions of what you should do. They control it, and you're a victim of it. And then ask this president, if you really care about us, and we're the ones who got you elected, why don't you demand this legislature, or by executive order, or however you choose to do it, to forgive all interest on student loans and allow us to be able to file bankruptcy if we qualify out of student loans. Why not try something like that? That is doable. It takes grassroots organizing. But hey, isn't it worth it compared to what you're looking at otherwise? I'm Gary Knoll. Now let's go over to my guest who is standing by. I gave you his bio earlier in the program. Professor Melvin Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and an adjunct professor in government studies at Johns Hopkins University. And for 24 years, through the administrations of Johnson and Bush Sr., he had served in the CIA and the Department of State as a Soviet analyst. And he was also a professor of international relations at the National War College in for 18 years. And he's with us now. He's also just released a book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, that dives into the warnings of Eisenhower concerning the dangers of the military-industrial complex to the American economy, security, culture, and shows how those warnings have come to pass over the course of the presidencies of Obama. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Goodman.
Thank you, Gary. It's good to be with you.
Now, I'm going to ask Matt, our engineer, to find the quote. It's a short quote from President Eisenhower. I think that the people who hear us mention his speech, since it was a short speech, might be worth having that put on. In the interim, there are some areas that I would like you to focus on. Almost universally, when we're talking about those on the official left, the corporate left, MSNBC, for example, and the official right, Fox News and many of the others, they all say, well, one says we should eviscerate a lot of these programs, but never the military programs, never the spy programs, never any of these agencies. That they want to untouch. They don't want to go near it. Don't want to debate it. Other programs they want to argue over, you know, like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, et cetera. But that concerns me. Here is what President Eisenhower said in his last speech before leaving office.
My fellow Americans, this evening I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
I think that's rather clear. So here is my question. During the past 12 years, when we look at the coverage of our entering wars in the Middle East and meddling militarily with various countries, there appears to be a struggle between two competing mindsets. There is military mindset at the Pentagon and our generals and admirals who interpret foreign and national security in their own way. Then there's the political mindset. When we look back at all of our presidents since Eisenhower, we need to admit that there were rather clueless about the type of worldview that characterized the military careers. So would you speak about this clash of mindsets, the military and the political, and what the consequences of that has been for our national security?
Well, thank you, Gary. I would love to do that. But first of all, let me thank you for playing that. I haven't heard that in a while, and I knew it was compelling, but until you hear it in Eisenhower's own words, you forget how compelling that statement was. I was lucky in a way because I was an undergraduate at Johns Hopkins University when he gave that speech, and the president of Johns Hopkins was Milton Eisenhower. And we used to meet with Milton Eisenhower from time to time. I was on a student committee. And he told us that in his hand, in Ike's hand, he wrote in congressional, so it should have been military-industrial congressional complex, because Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower, thought that was the key to the problem. When he gave the speech, he dropped congressional, and his brother asked him why, and he said he thought it was enough to take on the military and the industry. It was too much to take on the Congress. But in the interim, the problem has gotten far worse than anything that I think even Ike could have imagined, because it's not really defense spending in that sense of the word. It's really military spending, and I think if we thought about it as military spending, we might be more willing to look for where there could be savings or where there was unnecessary spending. Eisenhower, after he gave that speech, was sitting around with his close advisors, and he was ruminating, and he said, you know, God help the United States when my successor is sitting in the chair I'm sitting in now and have no understanding, no knowledge whatsoever of dealing with the military. And by and large, as you've alluded to, we have not had presidents who have known anything about the military. The current one really came into office very uninformed about the military. Bill Clinton was uninformed. You had presidents with some military experience who were not willing to control the military, such as George Herbert Walker Bush, or presidents who were totally clueless about the military, such as his son, George W. Bush, who took us to war with lies, an illegal and immoral war. So the problem, and the question as you phrase it, is when I look at the military budget, this has become the new third rail of American politics. We always think of Social Security as the third rail. I think our congressmen, particularly in the Senate, now look at military spending as a jobs program. So they don't look askance at any of these military programs. Even liberals, so-called liberal senators, look at the two from California, for example, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, who are probably liberal on certain domestic issues. But on defense spending or military spending, any weapon system that is procured in any fashion in their state of California has become a good weapon system and something they approve of. And where the military-industrial complex has been smart, and Lockheed Martin is smarter than most of them, they design weapons programs to be located virtually in every state in the Union. The F-35, which has now been grounded because of cracks in an engine blade, that is produced in about 47 of our 50 states. So there's a bipartisan notion out there that military spending is good for the economy, military spending is good for the society in general, and they've ignored another Eisenhower speech that dealt with the Cross of Iron, in which he spelled out everything we spend in the military will take away from what we can spend on the economy. So we're talking about the sweat of our laborers, the hopes of our children, the brain power of our scientists and engineers, all will be compromised for this pursuit of military supremacy, which could never be defined in any sense. So what we do is exaggerate the threat on the one hand, and we exaggerate our necessity for these weapon systems as we look for silver bullets. The F-35 is supposed to be the silver bullet in the sky. Well, against what Air Force? The United States hasn't been challenged in the air since the end of World War II. Yet we never stopped building another state-of-the-art, so-called state-of-the-art aircraft. And it runs throughout the system with these Cold War platforms that continued to be built even though the Cold War itself ended over 20 years ago.
Let me follow with that idea you just shared with us. What are your views about the U.S. being in a war economy today? In the Reagan years, although we were not engaged in any full-fledged war, the U.S. still witnessed one of the largest defense budget increases ever during peacetime. And as you have detailed, the Soviet threat was fabricated in order to legitimize our increasing military expenses. And to what degree do we see that scenario being played out today in our war on terrorism? And one final thing, I'm sure that you're fully aware of what we've been doing with this administration to posture against China by creating some military alliances in Australia, New Zealand, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, as if somehow that will represent a military threat against China. So I'm looking at China and Russia. Neither one are going to go to war. They have too much to lose. 16 of the 20 largest cities in the world are in China, and that would disrupt their entire economy. And they just passed the United States last Tuesday in producing more goods than any other country in the world. And so when we're posturing militarily at these people in essence to try to say there's a new Cold War afoot and we better get ahead of it, unlimited spending, let's do this, that, and the other, I'm saying, and you've got 18 million hungry children, you've got 46 million Americans who've lost their homes and are out on the streets or couch surfing, you have 15% of the senior citizens who can't afford medicines, their mortgage, electricity, and food. Why aren't you paying any attention to our infrastructure? You've got your priorities wrong. We shouldn't have another false Cold War. Your thoughts, please.
Well, the 1980s were, I think, the real turning point, and 1991 was the missed opportunity. The turning point was the Reagan peacetime buildup. It was the largest peacetime buildup in the history of the United States. Here was the Soviet Union in decline, headed for demise by 1991 when it dissolved peacefully. So they're getting weaker and weaker while we're building up our military arsenal, our military budget, totally unnecessary. And it's done and justified with false intelligence provided by the CIA, which was my reason for leaving the CIA in 86 to go to the National War College to teach and then resigning in 1990. It was a protest against the politicization of intelligence by William Casey and his deputy, Robert Gates, who then became the Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush and was kept on, which I must say, stunned me when Obama, who was promising change and acknowledging that we maintain our security without sacrificing our liberty to any extent, he keeps on this Cold War Secretary of Defense from the Reagan era in the 1980s. And then the real missed opportunity was 22 years ago. You had the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Warsaw Pact, the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was a chance to really debate what the new national security arena was all about, to get away from Cold War thinking. But is, again, as you suggest, the Pentagon always needs an enemy. And frankly, I think maybe our democracy always needs an enemy to maintain the discipline of the citizenry. And China stepped into that opening since the Soviet Union was no longer there. And you have to realize, and I certainly did teaching at the National War College for 18 years, what it means when you select an enemy, when you select a threat. It means it has a role to play in all of your war gaming, a role to play in all of your military planning, a role to play in justifying all of your military procurement. And to me, if there was ever a self-fulfilling prophecy, it's this kind of threat assessment. I cannot imagine a scenario that would find the United States and China going to some strategic confrontation. It's certainly not anything that China wants. It's certainly not anything that the United States should desire. But as you say, you have an Obama administration that on the very day they closed down the unfortunately named Camp Victory in Iraq, the largest U.S. military base in Iraq, in December 2011, they announced the pivot to Asia. And what does that pivot mean? It means moving 60% of all of our military power that was in the Middle East and a good part of our military power that was deployed in Europe to Asia for a totally unnecessary military confrontation. So what I worry about is since the end of the Cold War, there's always been a threat. It has always been exaggerated, and think about it. It was the Soviet Union, or it was Communist China, or Red China, or the Sino-Soviet nexus, even though they were at odds, and in 1969 went to war with each other. There was the so-called threat of international communism, which never existed as a threat to the United States. And now, frankly, we're exaggerating the threat of international terrorism, fighting the global war on terror, even though Obama has stopped the use of the war, global war, the term global war on terror. We're still fighting it, and you see spreading activity with drone aircraft in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, the use of military aircraft and CIA aircraft in areas where we're not at war. And now this is spreading to Africa. We're now building a drone base in Niger that will ultimately provide coverage for Mali, for Libya, for Nigeria, with no real briefings of the Congress as to what the ultimate strategy of the United States is, and how in the world do you justify the targeted assassinations, the targeted killings that are going on, something we have told the Israelis we don't like them pursuing in Gaza or the West Bank, but here we're doing all over the Middle East and Southwest Asia without the Congress having any real understanding of the strategy that's involved or how these decisions are made, and do we really want to live in a democracy where the President of the United States essentially has a hit list and can pick the targets for these drone aircraft without any judicial review or check and balance within the system. So clearly, and again, Eisenhower warned about this, when you have a condition of permanent war, and we've been in permanent war since 9/11, you will have a great sacrifice of civil liberties, of personal liberties, and a lack of control over the national security interests of the United States. The citizenry are ultimately not involved.
My final question on this issue is, during the Bush years, there was the passing of the Intelligence Reorganization Act of 2004, which basically reduced the CIA's role in the decision-making of intelligence received and placing the primary responsibility for intelligence assessment under the Director of National Security. That was a new position that the Bush White House had created. So what was that really about? And what are the
ramifications? What it was really about was downgrading the CIA and to make sure the CIA couldn't really produce independent, objective, rigorous intelligence. What it did was to push the intelligence community closer to full control by the military, by the Pentagon. We've had an intelligence czar since 2004 under the Intelligence Reorganization Act, except for that first year when you had a former State Department diplomat, John Negroponte, as the intelligence czar. All the intelligence czars have been either retired or active duty 3- and 4-star generals. It's the militarization of the intelligence community that has helped to remove a check and balance on the system, because now military intelligence, which is typically worst-case intelligence, and I was involved in intelligence when I was in the U.S. Army years ago, and of course also taught at the National War College, this fear of relying on military intelligence was the very reason why Harry Truman created the CIA in 1947. To find intelligence that would be outside the policy process, objective, balanced intelligence. You know, truth is elusive, but at least you don't want an intelligence agency that's grinding a policy axe and really just producing intelligence to justify policy, which, of course, the CIA did in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2002 and 2003. So the intelligence reorganization made a bad situation even worse. And Obama then comes along, and like his predecessor, he appoints a 4-star general, and the example would be David Petraeus, as the director of CIA. Well, you already have a retired 3- or 4-star general, James Clapper, who's running the National Intelligence Office. He is the intelligence czar. Obama made it even worse in his first year because he appointed a retired 3-star general, James Jones, a Marine general, to be the National Security Advisor, which clearly didn't work, and he was forced to retire within 2 years. But it's this militarization that I write about in the National Insecurity book, The Cost of American Militarism, because it's removed a key part of the balance in the policy process, and we need to correct that imbalance.
Final question. If you had to summarize the long-term cost of America's militarism and where it has brought us today, where you believe it's going to take us, what would it be and what can we do about it?
Well, the cost overall has clearly been in blood and treasure. Think of the over 4,000 Americans who died in Iraq, untold hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians who died in that war, but Donald Rumsfeld made sure his military did not count innocent civilian deaths. Think of the over 2,000 Americans who died in Afghanistan, where there is no strategic gain for the United States whatsoever. and the tens of thousands of innocent civilians in Afghanistan who've died. And then when you look at the treasurer of the United States, when you think of the so-called deficit problem and debt problem that we face, and we cite the numbers of $3.5 to $4 trillion, more than half of that is unnecessary military spending. A good deal of the rest of it were the George W. Bush tax cuts, which we couldn't afford at the time, you know, fighting a war basically by pursuing loans from China while we were reducing our own taxes and going on a dangerous level of consumption, which finally fell apart in 2007 and 2008. And then you go back to the Cross of Iron speech, and it's really what Eisenhower said. Look at the schools we can't build, the roads that we can't build, the bridges that we can't repair. The infrastructure cost has been huge in terms of what the United States can do now and what it'll be able to do over the next 5 years. This is where the real constraints are in policy, and the constraints are due to the fact that we've invested far too much, spending as much as the rest of the world combined on the military alone, and the military figures that you read about and hear about are greatly underestimated because they don't include the nuclear spending by the Department of Energy for a nuclear force that's tremendously overbuilt and continues to be modernized when we don't need that kind of modernization. When you think of a national missile defense that doesn't work, but for which we spend $10 billion a year and have been throwing money at this project for the last 50 or 60 years, even though we've never made it work. So the costs go on and on.
I appreciate your deep and profound insights on this issue. And for 24 years, through the administrations of Johnson Bush Sr., you served the CIA and the State Department and also taught at the National War College for 18 years, so you have a unique insider's view. The new book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, published by City Light Books. Thank you very much for being with us today, Professor Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Gary, for spending so much time on this very important subject. Few people are really addressing it.
Well, we address progressive issues. I'm Gary Knoll. That's all the time we have today. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow, and at 7 p.m. tonight, we have the Progressive Commentary Hour. Now we go to the talkback part of our program, where it's your opportunity to call in and share your points of view, questions, and issues. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And we'll take some calls right now, see who's on the line. We have Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from Rashad from Brooklyn, and he said that he works in media analysis, and he's been listening to you for a long time, and he enjoys it. And he says that he happens to know the rating of each of the WBAI programs. And when he heard about how many new listeners you said you had, he had to verify it. And he said, indeed, you were right. And he said, in fact, do you know, are you aware, that you have more listeners coming into your program than the total amount of listeners on WBAI each day? He also said it's true of KPFK WPFW, and that's daily. So he said the numbers you quoted were exact. They were accurate. And he said you probably have about 10 times more people than all of Pacifica combined. And his question for you is, with your audience growing that strongly, does Pacifica ever communicate with you as to how maybe they can increase their audiences? And by the way, he also puts a P.S. He missed hearing you fundraising in this last fundraiser.
Okay, well, when BAI sends out the premiums from 5 months ago, we'll be happy to fundraise again. I can't ask people to send money if they didn't receive their last premiums. It just wouldn't be right. And though I fully understand and appreciate BAI paying money to more people than it has money to pay, I believe that you must always make the audience your very first obligation. Otherwise, you'll just lose them. We're losing about 70% of the audience here on WBAI, which is unfortunate. That's why it's so small, and they now have the lowest amount per day in the history of the station. At some point, someone will stop and say, why are we at where we're at? And then hopefully enlightened minds look at the problem. No one's ever asked for my input. I would be happy to give it, but there's just layers upon layers upon layers of individuals and committees and groups that run these stations and the foundation. They have their own methods. They have their own philosophy. And if it's working for them, good. If it's not, then it's for them to decide they have to change it. Just doing more of the same is not going to get them the outcome they need. Here's the simple takeaway message. Today we have more venues for information than ever before in American history, mainly because of the Internet. If you were the only place in town for people to go to get a particular point of view, then you had a captive audience. But in a healthy and thriving environment, there's many different voices offering different points of view. And those that have the best messages are going to keep the audiences. Those who don't, won't. So you better be doing your homework if you're going to be sharing information today, because otherwise there'll be someone right beside you who will have done their homework, and they'll get that audience. Once not in sleeves, it's very hard to get them back, almost impossible, because the ways that we watch television or cable or listen to radio are different. More and more people are listening on their phones today than ever before. We have tens of thousands of people listening to the show over the telephone. 3 years ago, 2 years ago, that didn't exist. Today it does. So people are not locked into having to be at a particular place at a particular time to listen or miss the message. So the medium has changed what you can and can't do. So I'm hopeful and optimistic that at some point there will be a shift in consciousness and a new way of looking at growing the audiences on Pacifica. I hope they do. Want them to survive. That's why we're still there, still helping them. We're out of time. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
And by the way, we've got a very powerful show tonight at 7 o'clock. You will not want to miss it. I didn't have a chance to do the commentary that I'd written, but I'll do it tonight, all right, at 7 p.m. A very powerful person on tonight to join me. Let's say hello to Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. Of course, today is Sequester Day. We're taking a look at this great sequester.
Well, good. That looks like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, sure. Tons and tons and tons of fun.
Yeah. Just like getting four colonics in a row on a subway platform. Have a good show.